The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hewitt inside the Beltway on this June 15th, 2020. The rundown. NATO expands its focus on China. According to the Washington Post, NATO leaders on Monday agreed to pivot their alliance to a more confrontational stance towards China. A landmark shift? I don't think so. I'll talk later in the program with former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I don't think this is a landmark shift. I think NATO has been focusing on China for a long time. But anything to cheerlead the new president along. The New York Times did the same thing, reporting China's rising military ambitions are presenting NATO with challenges that must be addressed, the 30-nation Western alliance said Monday. The first time it has portrayed the expanding reach and capabilities of the Chinese armed forces in such a potentially confrontational way. Again, that's just puff talk about Joe Biden making a difference, but we'll talk with Admiral Stavridis and Mike Pompeo and Tom Cotton about that today. Senate Democrats, Republicans prepare to sell nearly $1 trillion infrastructure deal to the White House, according to the Post. Congressional members are set to return to the Capitol, facing a pivotal week where they're going to try and persuade each other to get the 60 votes. We're talking to folks one by one, just asking folks to be open, said Senator Mitt Romney. Yesterday on this program, Mitch McConnell said 50-50 chances of that passing. Red line is any new taxes. He also said that he would block a Democratic nominee in 2024 if he were the majority leader. And he wasn't even certain he wouldn't do it in 2023. Well, my goodness, heads exploded across the United States. You would have thought that people had been told that he was executing at dawn, people that he just picked up on the street. In a blue state, Ali Velshi was guest hosting for Rachel Maddow on MSNBC last night, ran this commentary about my conversation with McConnell. Cut number 8.
Prior to becoming a judge herself, Jackson clerked for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who's currently facing calls to step down from some liberals who worry about a repeat of what happened in 2016 when Republicans blocked President Obama from filling Justice Scalia's seat. On that front, we got some less than surprising news today from Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell about his plans in the event of a Supreme Court vacancy. When asked if he would allow Biden to have a Supreme Court pick in 2024 if Republicans took control of the Senate next year, McConnell said, quote, "I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no." Of course, McConnell didn't have a problem confirming Trump's third Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett, just 8 days before the 2020 election. In today's interview, McConnell would not even ramp up the pressure on the 82-year-old Breyer to retire even more. So as Rachel would say, watch this space. It's uniquely important space.
You know, I think Ali should have sent the people to my website. As a colleague, he should have said, by the way, the full interview is at HughHewitt.com, and it's not surprising in the least. Mitch McConnell explained that if the party opposite the president's is in control of the Senate in election year, they'll act the same way and have acted that way for more than 100 years. But he's right about the incredible, incredible reaction to yesterday's interview. I'll play some of that. It was all over the place, and it's just sort of routine. But the left used it to amp up the pressure on Stephen Breyer. The privileged pod boys of the Obama years came out and demanded that Breyer retire. You know, I just don't think he's going to be listening. He's going to be paying really close attention to a bunch of 30-somethings who worked for President Obama, after all, in deciding to vacate the bench before the most important term of his long tenure as a leader of thought on the Supreme Court. It also gave me the idea, which I put out yesterday, the Federalist Society, FedSoc. They should name an award the McConnell Award and give it annually to that legislative or elected leader, Congress, president, or governor, who does the most to advance the judiciary, either at the national level or the state level. to save the judiciary for originalists and for the constitutions of the state and the federal government. The McConnell Award would become a much coveted award in legal circles and should be named for the guy who saved the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, the United States Senate did confirm D.C. Circuit nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson to replace Merrick Garland yesterday, a vote to 53-44. No one, it was just a rather ordinary nominee. Some people think she's too liberal on the Republican side, but Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham all voted to advance her nomination. Republicans in the Senate are saying, okay, she's a liberal, but president gets his nominees absent a character issue. That's the way it should always be. Companies are pushing employees to prove they are vaccinated for COVID-19. They're getting some blowback. They're getting some cooperation. Morgan Stanley and others are out there saying, and you've got to be vaccinated to come to work. A group of 100 Houston Methodist Hospital employees filed a lawsuit challenging the mandate. It was dismissed. That does not violate HIPAA. I got asked that yesterday. HIPAA applies to medical care providers. It doesn't apply to employers. Now, employers cannot dismiss you if you don't get vaccinated and you have a religious or a medical reason for not doing so. But they can certainly ask if you have been vaccinated. Terry McAuliffe, our friend Terry, who thinks I am the best talk show host in America, yesterday called critical race theory concerns a right-wing conspiracy. Yes, he did. Fox News has the story, but don't believe me. Believe Cut 19. Here's Terry McAuliffe.
All the Republicans are talking about like critical race theory, and they're making this huge deal about it, and it's all the conversation in the news of Virginia. Like, what are you going to say to all those people making education about that?
That's another right-wing conspiracy.
Okay.
This is totally made up by Donald Trump and Glenn Youngkin. This is who they are. It's a conspiracy theory.
Okay.
And you know what people want to know about? Why are we not paying our teachers? Why are we down 1,000?
Stop right there. Why are we not paying our teachers? People want to know about why we are not paying our teachers. I've been all over Virginia for 4 years. No one's ever told me that. That's just Terry McAuliffe hitting the replay banks from 8 years ago. Democrats have run this state for 8 years. If we're not paying the teachers, it's a Democratic problem. Terry's in trouble on critical race theory and education generally. Headline in the New York Times, Vatican warns U.S. bishops don't deny Biden communion over abortion. In fact, it was one Jesuit priest, Antonio Spadaro, who said the concern in the Vatican is not to use access to the Eucharist as a political weapon. And this month, the Pope said communion is not a reward of saints, but the bread of sinners. His top doctrinal official, Cardinal Luis Ladaria, wrote a letter to the American bishops warning them that the vote could become a source of discord rather than unity within the episcopate and the larger church in the United States. You know, what they ought to have explained is that's a diocese-by-diocese decision by the bishop who's in charge there, not a Vatican decision. Lordstown Motors. I always disclose when I make a move in the market. I bought some Lordstown Motors yesterday because they had such a rough day. They dropped below $10 a share because the chief executive and top financial leader have resigned amid a board committee report saying some of the aspects of disclosure that made about truck pre-orders were inaccurate, but they dismissed a scathing attack by some people accused of being short sellers. Lordstown Motors stock share ride, RIDE, is the future of Warren, Ohio. So I am hoping that the hometown truck maker gets going and draws the attention of all those people over at Wall Street Bets. It is one of those companies that might, like AMC and GameStop. But generally, I just want them to make trucks in Lordstown again. The vaccines offer significant protection against the COVID-19 Delta variant. Now, the Delta variant is spreading fast everywhere. It is not any significantly more lethal than all the other variants, but it is far more contagious. And so if you haven't been vaccinated, get out there and get vaccinated because it's coming to a theater near you soon, the Delta variant. England, in fact, had to extend their lockdown by 4 weeks, dashing the hopes of businesses for some additional economic aid at the same time that they extended it. Nor, according to the Telegraph, did Boris Johnson commit to the July 19 unlocking. He said it's definitely July 19, unless it's not. Meanwhile, the EU and the U.S. are poised to resolve an Airbus-Boeing trade dispute that has lasted for 17 years. Hooray! Provided that there's equity there. I have to ask Kim Reed, the former head of the U.S. Export-Import Bank, about that when the next Nixon seminar convenes. In Israel, Bennett is the prime minister. Netanyahu is not the prime minister. They shook hands, and Netanyahu came out fighting from the opposition bench. Good news of the day, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain welcome the new Israeli government. They signaled the Abraham Accords are still in place and still stable. That's terrific news. Got a lot of show coming up today. Admiral Staff, of course, but in the last hour, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Senator Tom Cotton. We've got David Drucker coming along. Lots of news. 1-800-520-1234. Join me after the break right here on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, Inside the Beltway. That music means David Drucker is with us. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be here.
I was out with some friends last week at a Washington CNBC restaurant and wandered in and saw there the Drucker box where the Drucker's cigars and wine are stored. And I thought to myself, you know, the Washington Examiner must really be paying these people too much money when they can have a wine reserve box. You know what I'm talking about. And I just want to
know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly where you went, and I make no apologies for being a faux elitist. I enjoy my wine and I enjoy my food. You know, my wife also works for a living, so there is.
Yeah,
that.
I know, but I have not been over there when the Drucker's power couple around D.C. convene and open up their private reserve. So I was looking around the restaurant for you. I didn't see you. Hey, David, I want to talk to you about Leader McConnell on the show yesterday. Heads exploded on the left. Honestly, nothing he said was surprising, right? Why would they be surprised that Mitch is going to Mitch again?
Well, look, so nothing, when I read the transcript of the interview, nothing was surprising, but the way, but it got into semantics, right? So the way some of the headlines were written, because of the way you asked, either the way you asked the question or the way he answered, I can't remember, is I think what caused some of the uproar. When, you know, McConnell's rule, whether you like the rule or not, was in an election year, if the parties of the White House and the Senate are opposite controlled, there'll be no consideration of a nominee, not just no confirmation, right? No consideration.
No hearings,
but
no
the
votes.
Words, yeah. Right. But the election, but the term election cycle was thrown around and end of 2023. And so all of a sudden the headlines were, some of them, Mitch McConnell won't confirm, you know, the rule will apply basically to the year of 2023 and 24, not just the election year of 24. The rule will apply to the presidential election cycle, which technically begins the day after the 2022 midterm elections. But again, when I read the transcript, what he was saying essentially was the same thing that he has been saying, other than he kind of left open, well, what happens at the end of 23? We're not quite into 24. And he's like, well, we'll have to see. But other than that, you're right. There was nothing new, but the way in which it was interpreted or people chose to interpret it, made it sound to some like there was some expansion of the rule.
And that's why I wish they had included a link, because the context for the 23 comment was I brought up the Kennedy exception to the McConnell rule, which was Kennedy was nominated following the withdrawal of Doug Ginsburg and the defeat of Robert Bork in 1987. He was confirmed in early 88. So people mistakenly believe he was an election year confirmation. The conclusion of the process, which had begun the prior June, was in 88. But that is, and McConnell did make a little news by saying that's not a foregone conclusion. I think what he was leaving open there is the possibility of a Bork or a Doug Ginsburg, someone who has to withdraw, or Earl Warren, not Earl Warren, but Abe Fortas, who was also an election year nomination and withdrawal in 1968. But that was for character reasons. He was a crook. And they discovered that in the course of that. So none of this is actually news. That's what's astonishing to me, David. It's just not news. On the other hand, nobody had asked Mitch this yet. And I'm always amazed that center-left television networks that send people up to the Capitol and participate in the McConnell press conferences never ask him the obvious questions about judges. It's like they're allergic to judges.
Well, look, part of it, Hugh, is, you know, worldview, and part of it is just kind of understanding McConnell, and part of it is understanding what Republican voters are interested in. You know, but I think, you know, with so much of this, the questions we ask are driven by news in the moment of the day. And look, even I fall prey to that, where instead of looking ahead or trying to game out what's coming a year or two down the line. There is so much news happening. There are so many events. Even our editors, we all, center right or center left, we all want to break news of the day that's relevant in the moment or seems to be.
But what my point being, though, that became a big news story on all of the networks and about 100 different newspapers. It was the interview with Mitch McConnell. So they can make news if they simply ask obvious questions that are of interest to the Republican center right, which they never do. That is to me the most obvious reveal is not what McConnell said, but that it had not been asked before. And I haven't talked to the leader in 4 months.
Yeah, no, look, it's a good point. And these are questions that should be asked, that I try to ask, that sometimes escape me. And this is a good one. You know, in some cases, I wonder if it's a question I wouldn't have asked because I would have assumed the answer. I mean, Mitch McConnell has been pretty clear about his approach to Supreme Court justices. And
yep.
Yet it's a great question to ask from a midterm election standpoint. If you're a majority leader again, how are you going to handle Biden's judicial nominees?
And it's also the advantage of radio, David. I had 20 minutes with the leader, and most people get one or two questions in the hallway. And it's just
correct.
The advantage of radio. And television doesn't even like the leader because he's Southern, right? He takes a long time to answer a question that you just got to have time. David M. Drucker on Twitter and in the Washington Examiner. Thank you, David. I'm coming back with one of his colleagues, Byron York. Later in the show, Tom Cotton, Mike Pompeo. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Tuesday, June 15th in the year of our Lord, 2021. Joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Fox News. Good morning, Byron.
Good morning, Hugh. And I just want to say right off that I do not have any personal cigar collection or wine stash or any of that in any of these shishi Washington restaurants.
You know, Drucker.
Washington restaurants.
Drucker is leading a high life, and I think you should call to the attention of the editors that
he is. I mean, I don't think I could afford his pocket square collection, so
no,
I'm going to have to look into this.
Yeah, you know, he once said, and when I was doing the debates in 2016, I needed a tie, and so Generalissimo went out to find a tie and consulted with Drucker, and they came back with a $250 tie, which is about the total cost of every tie I've ever purchased from every thrift shop. You know, clothes just are Drucker, they matter to, they don't matter to me. Byron, I was talking with him, you heard me, about the reaction on cable news and across the DC and Reuters and Yahoo News to Leader McConnell's comments, rather unextraordinary on my show yesterday. Why a heart attack on the left over the obvious statement that if the party is the same as the president, nominees sail through in election years, and if it's opposite, they don't?
Well, I think in the news business, occasionally, we do have frenzies when somebody states the obvious. And, you know, you say to yourself, would Mitch McConnell really change his position, you know, after what he did with Merrick Garland in the Scalia opening? Well, no. But you have a lot of Democratic anxiety. And remember, these people who were talking about this on the news are Democrats. You have a lot of anxiety. You have a 50-50 Senate. That's very difficult. And you have this pattern of increasingly partisan Supreme Court votes. I mean, if you look just at, I looked this up while you were talking, if you look just at the three Trump nominations, Gorsuch is confirmed 54-45 with three Democratic votes. That's Manchin, Heidkamp, and Donnelly. And Kavanaugh is confirmed 50-48 with one Democratic vote. And then Barrett is confirmed 52-48 with zero Democratic votes. So now they have 50 votes in the Senate. So, you know, getting a Breyer replacement or anybody else through the Senate right now is going to be difficult. So if they lose the Senate in 2022, even if it's 51-49, they're deeply worried what's going to happen.
And then the overstatement follows. Joy Reid being, she's a friend of mine. I've been working with her for years, saying that Mitch McConnell is wickedness in high places and is evil. And, you know, let's just overstate things just a touch. But what they don't deal with is that Harry Reid is the guy who changed the filibuster rule for judges, generally, tried to leave the Supreme Court exception. Mitch said, no, 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 sauce for the goose, on for the gander. We're not going to play by your rules and have you break it later when it's your nominee, which is what the Reid rule allows them to do. But the thing that the key point of the interview, Byron, is that the Supreme Court is dealing this year. We're waiting to hear about the Catholic Church in Philadelphia. We are waiting. They did not take the Harvard case yesterday. They waited. They asked for the opinion of the Department of Justice under Joe Biden, which was a great tactical move because now the Biden administration must explicitly state whether they're for or against discrimination on Asian American applicants. And then the justices can decide to take the case. And then next year it's abortion and guns. Why would Stephen Breyer quit when his nomination is just as assured in 2023, June, July of 2023, in that summer, and get himself off before the crucial year in his judicial career?
Well, I think that, first of all, there's zero reason for him to quit right now.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think the Democratic anxiety, and thus the, you know, the MSNBC anxiety, will increase next year, depending on what the Senate map looks like. But I think, you know, I think the lesson of Amy Coney Barrett for Democrats would be, look, if you've got a nomination, if you've got a vacancy and a Democratic president and the election is in 10 minutes, get this thing done in 8 minutes. So I think this pressure on Breyer is actually going to increase because, you know, with a Republican Senate, they can just kind of forget it. Now, I thought it was interesting in your interview with McConnell about what happens in a 2023 situation, if there's a Republican Senate and President Biden, what happens there? 2024, there's just no doubt. If there's a Republican Senate and a President Biden, there's not going to be a confirmation. There's not even going to be a consideration.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter who the nominee is. It's just like, it's not correct. About Merrick Garland. It was no hearings, no votes before Garland was nominated. He just said it out of the box.
Correct. And he does have historical precedent on his side about this. So the question, though, is 2023. And I think McConnell left the door open. I mean, if the Senate will not even consider a nominee of the opposite party in the year before election, because McConnell used the phrase, if we're in the middle of an election. So, you know, what does that mean? I think if the party would not consider a Biden nominee in 2023, then I think we've got some sort of breakdown in the system of confirming Supreme Court justices.
What I think he was leaving open there, that's the Bork exception. Bork was nominated in 87, defeated after a long summer of hearings on a simple majority vote, no filibuster. Doug Ginsburg was nominated and then withdrawn because he had smoked dope with Harvard law students. And then Anthony Kennedy was nominated in the fall of 87 and confirmed in 88. And so when he said, we'll have to see, I think he was reserving the right to object to a nominee on an extremely ideological. There are some members of the California Supreme Court who should never be confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. They're just outside of the norm of American judging. And
I think one flaw in what you're talking about is, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, you're talking about examples from the Reagan administration. And every Democrat believes that everything became completely different when Donald Trump was president. Their sense of grievance, their sense of entitlement, their sense of belief that they can just do anything increased. So, I just don't think they're going to say, well, what about Doug Ginsburg? You know, what about Bork, et cetera? They're going to want to get something done when they've still got, what do you call what they have in the Senate? It's a 50-50 tie. There's no, Democrats did not win a majority
They have effective control.
They have effective control. Thank you very much. Yeah. So now, they're going to want to do it while they've got effective control.
And they're worried about somebody dying or jumping parties, like Jim Jeffords jumped parties the last 50-50 Senate from the Republican to the Democrats. And Joe Manchin could conceivably do that. I don't think Kristen Sinema will. And you could also have someone die. People die. Tim Johnson had a stroke, remember? And the 50-50 Senate became... It was still a 51-49 Senate, but he was disabled. And so it was very difficult for them to get their votes for a long time. Byron, I want to talk to you about Michael Waltz. My son works for him. I always declare that. Yesterday, Nancy Pelosi attacked him for labeling the squad the Hamas caucus. I think because that's a particularly effective categorization of the caucus, a label that will stick. She said it was dangerous. It reminded me of the Sarah Palin using the cross here. Nonsense, dangerous. That is now their response to anything that's effective. It's just absurd. It's just absurd that she would equate Hamas and the Taliban with the United States and Israel. And Hamas caucus fits. Should Pelosi have taken the bait? I mean, she did.
Ask this. Did Pelosi's response hurt her with any Democrat at all?
No, you're right.
Okay. No, there you go. Did, so I think the answer is yeah, she should take the bait because
now
look, calling something dangerous, anti-democratic, or racist is these are default Democratic rhetorical positions. So you talk about unsurprising news. I think that her response is unsurprising news.
Okay, I got to get in this very quickly. Terry McAuliffe, Cut 19 for Byron York's ears.
Mr. President, all the Republicans are talking about like critical race theory, and they're making this huge deal about it, and it's all the conversation in the news of Virginia. Like, what are you going to say to all those people making education about that?
That's another right-wing conspiracy.
Okay.
This is totally made up by Donald Trump and Glenn Youngkin. This is who they are. It's a conspiracy theory.
Okay.
And you know what people want to know about? Why are we not paying our teachers? Why are we doing
all right, Byron. I've never heard people say we're not paying our teachers enough. I hear everyone talking about critical race theory. Does Terry McAuliffe get away with calling it a conspiracy theory?
Well, I think maybe until a debate when his opponent actually lists examples from actual schools and curricula in Virginia. And then the conspiracy theory thing falls apart.
Byron York on Twitter, on Fox, and his daily memo available from the Washington Examiner. Thank you, Byron. Stay tuned, America.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me. My lover stands on.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show this morning. I'm in the Beltway. I don't know where Admiral James Stavridis is, retired United States Navy, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, former head of Southern Command, now chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, a member of the Carlyle Group. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. For the record, I'm in North Florida, but headed up to New York next week, like we all are, just starting to crack open the valve of travel.
Isn't that wonderful to get back? I went back and forth to California on Friday and Sunday, and it was great to stand in line and just be back on the road again, even though the pain in the neck's come along with it.
Yeah, indeed. And I'll take wearing a mask in an airport and on a plane all day long, as opposed to just being in lockdown in my beloved home state of Florida. So I've been out 3-4 times, and it'll just accelerate. And Labor Day, I think we're all starting to look at as truly the opening of the world again. And I think that's going to be accurate.
You are a WSB speaker, Washington Speakers Bureau speaker, I believe. Have you begun to go back out again for WSB?
I have.
Yep.
I'm doing a speech on Monday morning in Orlando for the American Public Power Association.
Back in the hunt again. Well, great. I want to talk to you about your time at NATO. What years were you Supreme Allied Commander, Admiral?
2009 to 2013, 4 years, the longest in recent history.
So President Biden is at a NATO meeting now. And what is that meeting? How would it relate to you as Supreme Allied Commander and Stoltenberg's role? Just sort of break down how NATO operates for the Steelers fans.
every 2 years, there's what's called a NATO summit. That's where all the heads of state and government, so the president of the United States, the prime minister of the United Kingdom, the president of France, the chancellor of Germany, that group of 30 heads of state themselves actually assemble for a summit. And as Supreme Allied Commander, my role every time that occurred, every year in those years, because of Afghanistan being such a big mission, 150,000 troops. So I would brief them. I would go to all the dinners. I would interact with all of them. I'd have side meetings with many of the leaders. And then the leader of the band, the master of ceremonies, is the position called the Secretary General of NATO, typically someone who has been a prime minister. During my time, it was a former prime minister of Denmark. Now it's the former prime minister of Norway, a man named Jens Stoltenberg. And he orchestrates the meeting. He's the host for the meeting. And he is also the person to whom I reported in my NATO hat. And in my U.S. hat, I reported, of course, to the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States. So there's a sketch.
Now, in terms of what NATO would work on, did you ever discuss China with your NATO allies as the Supreme Allied Commander?
Not even once. Furthest thing from the agenda. We talked about Afghanistan, Libya, the Balkans, piracy at sea. We talked about cyber, but in terms of today's agenda, which includes China and climate, those were simply not part of the discussions.
What about the eastern border of Afghanistan, and is it bumped up against China? I mean, was there any worry about that or conversation about the Chinese exploiting the Belt and Road Initiative there?
No, and what we worried about was kind of an early version of that would be that we, NATO, would go in and provide all the security, but the Chinese would come in behind us and exploit all the mineral wealth of
right.
Afghanistan. Folks may not know this, but Afghanistan is sitting on somewhere between $1 trillion and $2 trillion of minerals, rare earths, lithium, lapis lazuli. It's an extraordinary treasure trove. It's part of why China has remained somewhat interested. But in those days, it was all about fighting the Taliban, extinguishing al-Qaeda.
Okay, so at the NATO meeting, they are expanding their focus to China, a win for Biden in his first trip to the battered alliance. I will talk with Secretary Pompeo and Senator Cotton next hour. I think they will object to this being the first time anyone's paid attention to China, because that's what they did for at least 2.5 years that Mike was the Secretary of State. Do you welcome this increased focus of NATO on China? You've obviously got 2034 behind you, your best-selling novel about a potential future war with China, so you think about China a lot. Do you welcome NATO putting it on the agenda formally?
Oh, 100%. And you have to give the Trump administration a great deal of credit for seeing this looming tower. Mike Pompeo's speech, as you well know, in California toward the end of last year, really sketched out the risk. Tom Cotton has been credibly on this subject for 3 or 4 years minimum. And what we need to do now is have a plan to deal with it. And I think NATO can be a significant part of that. And I'll conclude on this by saying people may react to that by saying, well, wait a minute. NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. How does that work? Why would NATO focus on China? And the short answer is because China and Russia are drawing closer and closer together. They're going to very soon have a formal alliance, in my view. At the moment, they're simply aligned together. And as a result, if you're worried about the North Atlantic and worried about Russia, and you see China moving toward Russia, as well as its Belt and Road Initiative, as well as its human rights violations, as well as its preposterous claims of territoriality in the South China Sea, you've got to be responsibly aware of that as a NATO alliance. Look for NATO to take this quite seriously and move forward with the United States.
Now, China's been calling itself an Arctic adjacent country in an attempt to exercise some kind of jurisdiction. They're not Arctic adjacent. There's lots of water between them and China, but they're doing whatever China needs to do to assert its national interest, acting like a nation state. But when the British dispatch two carriers to operate with our forces in the Pacific, how does that, does NATO know that their two carriers are departing, or does NATO know that a carrier from the PACOM is headed up to the Mediterranean? That's where the idea of NATO not knowing what's going on with China struck me as kind of absurd. It's all one military, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And NATO, in the command centers of NATO, including the one in Mons, Belgium, which is the headquarters of the Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE, which was the command I led. That headquarters, believe me, is monitoring movements all around the world, to include the Pacific, to include the Arctic, certainly the Mediterranean, North Atlantic, the Baltic. It's a very coherent alliance in terms of surveillance globally, and it's informed by the satellite networks of all these countries, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, on and on and on. Again, very credible. And I think that I'm glad you mentioned the deployment, particularly of the Queen Elizabeth, the new British 65,000-ton aircraft carrier going out with British escorts, an American destroyer coming along with them. Where is it headed? Through the Indian Ocean to the South China Sea. France is not far behind. Germany is going to deploy to the South China Sea. You're going to see the NATO navies in particular move toward the Pacific.
And when they do that, what kind of a plan are they are they operating on? A Supreme Allied Commander plan? Are they operating on a PACOM plan? I just generally, and I don't think the audience knows, who's running the show when these concert of ships starts playing?
In very broad terms, U.S. Pacific Command in Honolulu, while they don't have formal command of the non-U.S. ships, Pacific Command functions kind of like a NATO commander throughout that vast Indo-Pacific region. And so they become a coordinating body for these national deployments. I can envision a period of time coming fairly soon, Hugh, when you'll see a more formal NATO deployment, multinational. We have that already in the Mediterranean, the North Atlantic. These are standing maritime naval forces where five or six ships will come together, each from a different country, have one nation in command of it, but it's under a NATO flag. That hasn't happened yet. That's the next logical step. Until it does, U.S. Pacific Command is kind of a clearinghouse for these operations.
Should NATO become PADO, and by that I mean from North Atlantic to Pacific Atlantic Treaty Alliance, do you think that's in the cards?
I do not, for the simple reason that we have many allies, partners, and friends in the Pacific, but the differences culturally, linguistically, historically between, say, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Singapore— they're quite significant. Thailand, Philippines, with whom we have treaties. It's very hard to see all of them coming together in a PATO. I kind of like the phrase. It used to be, you'll know this from your history, it used to be CETO, yeah. The Southeast yeah. Asia Treaty Organization. That existed at one time. It didn't survive because of those cultural, geopolitical differences. NATO continues because here are 30 democracies parked right on the rim of the Atlantic, 28 of them, of course, in Europe. It's got geography on its side, values, history. I think it would be very difficult to duplicate that in Asia. Instead, what should happen is NATO should up its game in terms of cooperating with the democracies I just mentioned. Then you have kind of a de facto system. And finally, the new idea in the Pacific is what's called the Quad. This is the alignment, not a formal treaty alliance, but an alignment between Japan, India, United States, and Australia. That's a pretty good group of four nations, a lot of capability. I think that's the closest we'll come to a NATO-like environment.
And then there's Five Eyes, which you add New Zealand. There are just a lot of different pieces on that puzzle, and it, what unites them all, let's have your final thought on it, is that they are democratic states. Vietnam can't be a part of this. I don't know that there are some of the Asian nations that fully qualify as democratic states. Vietnam certainly doesn't. But our democratic state allies, last minute to you, Admiral, that's the backbone of a global alliance, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got it right. And we ought to recognize that democracy comes in a variety of flavors, and we need to be sensible about who we work with. But the big ball in the constellation, in my view, is India. We ought to be doing everything we can to pull India toward the West. It is a democracy, a quite vibrant democracy, huge capability, geographically parked on that vast Indian Ocean. Finish on this. One Belt, One Road has one big problem, India, which is parked right there and will soon surpass China in population. India is a wonderful potential partner, ally for the United States and for our other partners in the
Pacific. That's why we need to rush vaccines there. Admiral Stavridis, always a pleasure. Thank you. Follow him on Twitter at Stavridis J. Follow me, friends, to relieffactor.com. Great sponsor of the show. Time for me to remind you, if you're going to go out and about and exercise today, you should have taken your relieffactor.com already. If you're in the car and you follow my advice, you have a bag in the car. If you forgot to take it before you left the house this morning, then you should go back and take it right now. Look, feel better every day, get active every day, and I am a preacher for activity. And if you are sedentary, today is the day you walk 100 yards, tomorrow 150, the day after that 200. Just get going with a walker or a cane or somehow move around. Go with a friend if you're infirm, and if you're young and you're not moving, start moving now. And you say, ah, I'm too heavy, start walking. Just start going. ReliefFactor.com will help you do that. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back on The Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, joined now by United States Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back.
Hey, Hugh. Good morning. It's good to be back on with you.
I want to talk about NATO and China this morning, jumping off from two headlines. The Washington Post: NATO expands focus on China, a win for Biden in his first trip to the battered alliance. Monday's discussion was a sharp expansion of NATO's efforts to confront Beijing after years when China was outside the focus of the defensive alliance. New York Times: shifting focus, NATO views China as a global security challenge. Again, parroting the Biden administration talking points that the China's rising military ambitions are presenting NATO with challenges that must be addressed. The description of China contained in the communique issued at the conclusion of a one-day summit meeting attended by President Biden reflected a new concern over how China intends to wield its rapidly growing military might and offensive cyber technologies. Are you of the opinion that NATO has never dealt with China before?
No, Hugh, that's not the case, although it's been fitfully and with some of their members, especially Germany, kicking and screaming. I mean, it's good to see NATO focused on the genuine threat to the free world in the decades ahead, which is communist China. Of course, Russia remains a threat, but China is the threat to the free and civilized world. I wish they would be able to call it that, as opposed to, I think they called Russia a threat and China a challenge. And that's in part because people like Angela Merkel want to keep selling Volkswagens and Beamers into China and sell all their industrial manufactured products into China. So there's still a lot of divisions in Europe, and you saw that at the G7 as well.
So I also cannot believe that NATO's been deployed in Afghanistan all these years without keeping eyes on China and its exploitation of the mineral resources or the border or the Belt and Road Initiative.
Sure, there's been some, interactions and encounters like that. All of these German leaders, of course, know what a threat China poses. to the United States and really to the entire free world. But so many of them and their industrialists are just so deeply in hawk to the Chinese Communist Party and access to its market and its low-cost goods. They've sent production over there for so long that they just don't want to take the stand that they should on things like Chinese investment to Europe, Chinese ownership of critical ports and shipyards and so forth, Chinese investments in European telecom systems, et cetera, et cetera.
I just asked Admiral Stavridis, I'll ask Secretary Pompeo, who's up at the bottom of the hour, should NATO become PAYTO, in other words, from the North Atlantic to the Pacific Atlantic Treaty Alliance, bringing in the democracy of Japan, Australia, and India into the alliance that deals with authoritarian regimes like Russia and China?
Hugh, NATO has always been centered in the North Atlantic, and its primary military threat has always been Russia, and that remains the case. We want our NATO partners to do more on things like Chinese investment into Europe or China trying to corner international markets. But I think we have to be clear-eyed that our European partners, minus Great Britain, simply don't have the military capability to defend themselves against both Russia and to help us in the Western Pacific against China. Some of them can't even defend themselves against Russia, nor do their peoples necessarily have the desire to stand up for each other. But in the Western Pacific, Great Britain can help us, as they are this year, sending one of their carriers across the globe. But the military balance of power in the Western Pacific will depend primarily on the United States and South Korea and Japan and Taiwan and Vietnam, the Philippines and India, not NATO countries.
Now, as one of the acknowledged rising leaders of the Republican Party, I want to play for you a clip of President Biden at NATO yesterday. I don't know why this came up. I don't know the question that preceded it, but it struck me as unusual for a NATO summit to be saying this by the President of the United States. Cut number 17.
The Republican Party is vastly diminished in numbers. The leadership of the Republican Party is fractured. And the Trump wing of the party is the bulk of the party, but it makes up a significant minority of the American people. And we'll see. We'll see.
What do you make of that, Senator Cotton?
I think Joe Biden is trying to find excuses for his own failures in these first 4 months in office. If he wants to see divisions in a party, I suggest that he looks at the congressional wing of his party, where fringe progressives are saying that Joe Manchin is defending Jim Crow, or what may be worse in their eyes, saying that Joe Manchin is worse than Mitch McConnell, Hugh.
Yeah.
If you want to talk numbers, Hugh, the Democrats have FDR and LBJ-sized ambition. Unfortunately for them, they don't have FDR, LBJ-sized majorities. The House majority is the smallest it's been in almost a century. And the Senate, they don't even have a majority. It's evenly divided. Chuck Schumer is the Senate floor leader. He is not the majority leader because he only controls the Senate by virtue of Kamala Harris being available to come down to the Capitol and break a tie on close votes. So Joe Biden came into office with negative coattails, something far different from Donald Trump or Barack Obama or George Bush or Bill Clinton. And you're seeing that in the Congress right now. And I think that clip you just played from Joe Biden reflects his recognition that he simply doesn't have the votes to pass his far left agenda. I mean, I don't know why he's bringing it up overseas when he should be representing the United States and making foreign policy. But I think that's beginning to dawn on both him and all the Democrats in Washington.
Your fellow Army veteran, Michael Waltz, I always note my son works for him. Michael Waltz and Jim Banks and another congresswoman put out a resolution of censure yesterday of Ilhan Omar for her comments. And then Michael Waltz called the squad the Hamas caucus. Nancy Pelosi did the predictable reflexes thing and said that was dangerous. What do you make of the censure motion? Would you vote for it if you were still in the House? And what do you make of the Hamas caucus description?
I would vote for it. I think they should probably go farther and remove Ilhan Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee. Anyone who compares the United States and Israel to Hamas and Taliban should not be deeply invested in making U.S. foreign policy. And if Ilhan Omar and her squad doesn't want to be attacked for making anti-American, anti-Israeli comments, here would be my suggestion. Don't make anti-American and anti-Israeli comments, and then you won't be attacked for it.
Yeah, I think if you are going to make the moral equivalence argument of the United States and Israel is the same as Hamas and Taliban, the Hamas caucus fits until you issue an unequivocal condemnation of a terrorist organization that fires thousands of rockets at civilians. The Taliban murders innocent civilians. I know why Pelosi's defensive. It's because the truth hurts, Senator Cotton.
Well, Pelosi's defense gets back to what we were talking about earlier, Hugh. Not only does the truth hurt, but she can't afford to lose her far-left squad. Remember, she can only lose four votes. I think the so-called squad has a self-avowed seven members, and they have a lot more far-left Democrats in the House as well. Hugh, they almost took down a spending bill last month that Pelosi was pushing for heightened Capitol security. Do you know why they took it down? Almost took it down?
No.
Because it gave more money to the Capitol Police. And the Democrats aren't in the business of funding the police. They're in the business of defunding the police. And it was only after an hour-long vote with arms twisted and promises made that Nancy Pelosi finally got two or three of those fringe Democrats to vote present instead of no, therefore reducing the number of yes votes she needed to pass that bill. That's why Nancy Pelosi is equivocal whenever Ilhan Omar compares America to Hamas, because she can't afford to lose her vote.
Now, let me talk about Leader McConnell. He came on yesterday and said the political equivalent of the sun rises in the east, meaning that if the party is different in the Senate than it is in the presidency, an election year nomination of a Supreme Court justice isn't going anywhere. Heads exploded across the spectrum. I mean, just I've got clip after clip after clip. Why do we get this? I think it's faux outrage, Senator Cotton. Of course it's not going to happen. We have the Scalia precedent. We have precedent going back to the 1800s on this issue.
Yeah, Hugh, I think this is just one more instance of the left's contempt for our Constitution that goes back as far as the 19th century, starting with Woodrow Wilson. I think it was outmoded and outdated. You know, the left frequently uses the term gridlock, which is the left-wing term for the separation of powers, checks, and balances. Huh. And that's exactly what Senator McConnell is talking about. If the American people elect Republicans to the House and to the Senate next year to put a brake on the Biden agenda, then that's exactly what they expect the Republicans in Congress to do. And that is what we will do.
You know, my colleague at NBC, Joy Reid, called Mitch the wickedness in high places and evil yesterday. Now, the leader is a very good leader and a superb Republican and probably the most effective legislative leader in my lifetime. I mean, the left is kind of unhinged here, Senator.
Well, that's why I said, Hugh, that when you've got fellow Democrats comparing Joe Manchin to Mitch McConnell, those are genuine fighting words in the Democratic Party. There's not much more they can insult them by saying that. And it just goes to show what an effective war leader Mitch McConnell has been.
You should drop by and see if Senator Manchin wants to join a majority. Senator Cotton, thank you. Always a pleasure. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back from Inside the Beltway. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.